Hello and welcome to the Eat PhD Team podcast, the podcast here to help you with your relationship with food and body by giving you evidence-based techniques to support yourself with a sprinkling of feminism, a dash of dismantling diet culture and a side of vulnerability as we share our own messy lives with you. I'm Emilia, a registered nutritionist and PhD with the sole purpose of making your life happier and healthier. If you love it, please do go wild and share it. And if you're ready for support with our coaching, details are in the show notes. Hello and welcome to episode number 259 of the Eat PhD Team podcast with myself and Becca. Hi Becca, how are you?
I am very well, thank you. Very zen, how are you?
I am great, thank you. Also very zen. We just had a somatic workshop with Katie and it was heavenly. And Anna, how are you?
Also very, very zen.
Oh gosh.
Super chill. It's quite nice.
I know, it's going to be a very relaxed podcast today. Which I'm here for it.
If I can speak this week.
First time for everything, babe.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see. Did that somatic practice like regulate the nervous system and help me enter my, what's the area of the brain where you can think clearly? Rational brain. There we go.
I thought you were going to say enter my Zen era. That's where my mind went there.
But that too.
Yeah. We were just discussing before the pod, one, why it's okay to scratch your ass cheeks and not your asshole. And two,
these are the types of conversations we have.
It's because, and I know that this happens to other people because I spoke to someone else about this on my call today. Why is it that why does it happen that sometimes you just, like, your clothes just make you get a really itchy ass? But so itchy right now. Do you know what I've done? I've had to take my trousers off. I'm sitting my butt's so much, just my ass cheeks are so itchy. I must have changed my washing powder.
I'm sitting here in fluffy pajama bottoms. Amelia has no pants on.
I'm just in my cozies. Amelia's, we were talking about it yesterday. I'm all for like cozy, comfy autumn feels right now. Bought myself a new jumper.
Nice. It is nice.
It is very nice. I also got two new jumpers delivered today. It's the season. Cozy girl era. I feel like I'm definitely too old to be talking about eras like this. You know how?
No.
Okay, great.
Transition though. It's like out with the old, in with the new. And I just like, yeah, getting a couple of different new items of autumnal wear. And it's like, I don't know, there's something symbolic about it.
I agree. I was speaking to someone this morning who I work with, who's in Australia. And she's like, oh, you're all getting excited for fall and we're just getting excited because I can't imagine anything worse than going into another fall and winter and it's summertime. I'm like, yeah, just the change of a season is delightful. It's a great time if you embrace it fully.
Yes. It is strange though that they're going to their summer. Like Roz saying, oh, it's really hot. And I'm like, it's actually strange how it's so contrasting, but
you know,
she was like, I have to be really mindful of like suggestions I give, you know, I'm on about like smoothie bowls, but actually what they might need is a comforting, wholesome
porridge.
Yeah. You know, nobody wants a smoothie bowl when it's sub 12 degrees outside, that's for sure.
It's true.
Okay, let's get started on the questions. Anna, do you want to go first?
Yes. Is it true that time on a diet should equal time off diet? Do you think you need to be out of a deficit for the same period you were dieting to make it easier for results?
I've never heard that before.
No. I think I have heard it before, but like in terms of, I don't know, prepping, or if someone's in like a growing, bulking, whatever you want to call it, cycle. I think that's maybe where that came from. Like, oh, you can only, you know, you have to spend equal amounts of time in each, I think the right words for it, but phase, yeah. So maybe that's where it's coming from.
No. I think people get it wrong in the sense of there's no specific time that you have to diet for. You just shouldn't be dieting forever.
And you don't, when it's tiresome to be dieting for a very long time. And people have diet breaks to support things like adherence and social times. And realistically, physiologically, diet breaks don't really do anything. We kind of know that now. But for preference and stuff, people might have them. But there's no reason why you should do that. But I think a reminder that a diet is a temporary thing. A diet is a temporary thing to get you to a place where you've got a healthy level of body fat that you're comfortable with, and then that's it. It's not a diet and then, okay, I'm waiting for a while, and then a diet, and then waiting for a while. It might be that if you've got, you know, longer term fat loss goals, or relatively more body fat to lose, or you know you're social every other month, so it works for you to do phasic dieting, i.e. 4 weeks intentional, 4 weeks maybe at maintenance, 4 weeks intentional. That might work, and there's some cool research around that, but it's relatively harder to stick to, blah blah blah. But yeah, it's very much personal preference. Becca, question.
Okay, maybe advice surrounding allowing yourself to fully rest when you know you need to but aren't particularly good at it.
Next week's podcast is a little bit about this on Monday's podcast, so that will be helpful for you as a side note. I think there's probably still an inherent level of glamorizing not resting. Glamorizing, it's kind of like what we used to do with perfectionism. We used to kind of, oh, I'm a perfectionist, it's really not great, but inside kind of thinking it's still a good thing, like what you'd say at a job interview. And I think there's still a little bit, and I don't mean this person's asked this question specifically, but I still think there's a little bit of, oh, I'm so bad at rest, I'm just naturally just, you know, I have to be a productive person and it's really hard. And I think, and again, this is not this person, this was me in the past for sure. And so it's important to look at your relationship with rest and hustle culture and productivity. And I do go into this in the podcast on Monday, but if you associate your productivity or your doing with worthiness, you're always going to struggle with rest. And so the advice really is to look at your self-worth and your self-esteem, as opposed to all of the advice that we can give you right now in terms of active rest and intentional rest, and if you don't rest then you won't be as productive, and we could go through all of those different types of rest and things to do. But realistically, it's important to look at why you still have that relationship with rest in the first place. And it might be more related to your body image, and your relationship with exercise and food, or it might be more related to your relationship with yourself and your self-worth, although those two things are rarely, you know, distinct.
I was going to say as well, like the stories that you tell yourself in terms of, oh, I've got so much to do, I haven't got the time to rest, or noticing like the feelings of, like I certainly used to have it, like the feelings of resentment if you see like family or partner or friends like relaxing, you know, like, well, how can they can do it and I've got so much to do? I'm like, well, if you plan it in and schedule that time to yourself and reframe how you think about rest, that's going to be super beneficial. And I mean, I know we've talked about, like, I talk about it like progressive overload, but equally thinking, okay, well, are there different ways? If you are someone that really struggles with rest, is there a middle ground? Like Amelia likes puzzles. Okay, cool. That's kind of, I don't know, cognitive rest, mental rest, but that might also be going for a walk with your friend and getting, like, it's still gentle physical rest, potentially emotional rest as well, like, and having a good catch up and just seeing if there's at the moment a bit of a middle ground for you.
Can I just say, I work with a lot of 30 something female or people who identify as women, business owners, and I work with all ages and all genders, but this week especially I've had a lot of calls with that demographic of people. And one of the most rewarding things I'm finding from work at the moment is seeing the transition in these people to a place where they want to work. They're starting to work from a place of calm and choice and values, instead of from a place of must do, have to, can't take any days off. And it's really interesting because all of them have recognized that their output is the same, if not better. But the headspace behind it is so much more restful and calmer. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because so many of them this week have said, I'm annoyed, or I feel sad for my 20-something self that worked from this place of no days off and not taking rest and trying to control everything and trying to get everything right. And I feel sad for that person that lived like that, or I feel angry for that person. I'm angry at myself for that person, which none of this, you know, anger is definitely not justified toward yourself for that. And I think it's just showing compassion towards your younger self of that's a shame that I had to go through that. But of course, all of these journeys that we go on are designed to support us in some way. And eventually when we get to this point of realization, it was important to go through that journey and that way of living. But honestly, if you're listening to this podcast and you're in your 20s and you're recognizing that you don't rest and you're not being enough and you're not slowing down enough, then give yourself props for recognizing that. And if you can, which you can, take action on it now. I assure you, you're going to be in a much more healthful place as you get older. And it's, I think, age is an incredible thing. And as we get older, these things become easier to recognize. And I still think 30s are the time that it's just like everything hits you where you're like, oh, I did all of these things. And that's really interesting. And now I move through it. And I don't know if you can ever really get to that in your 20s, but if you can, then great. Because your life is not meant to be like, your life is not meant to be lived from a place of scarcity and must and control. You can have a happier life, a more content life, and just as productive from a place of, you know, calm and peace and being. It's just a very hard thing to believe, I think, until you've done it.
Yeah. It is such a hard one to, I suppose, accept that actually you don't need to constantly be scrambling, trying to like be as productive and do as much as you possibly can. But then it's like that fine line between, by doing that, your work's going to be less quality anyway. So it's really counterproductive at some stages. And then to always remind yourself that like, you're not going to look back at the end and be like, oh, thank God I worked all these hours. Thank God I didn't see my family and friends as much as I worked. Says like, I'm after coming out of a really, really busy period of time, obviously just finishing my course and working full time and all of that. But I can see now already from having more leisure time and like switch off time that I think my quality of work is better. Like, not that I showed up to the podcast at the wrong time, but in terms of like tolerance and just what feels manageable, it's just so different. So that's like another eye-opening thing for me recently.
Tolerance is such a great word in this context. You are so right. And tolerance is so important in all jobs, in all walks of life, relationships, etc. Like that.
Mm-hmm. I think though there's that fear, you know, like when we talk about self-compassion and how like, if I'm kind to myself, then I just won't do these things. And it's the same with rest. Like if I allow myself to stop, then I'm just never going to keep up with the level of productivity. Or it's not productivity, let's be honest, the level of busyness that I usually am. It's like, no, but like Becca said, the quality of your work or just the energy that you have to do the usual day-to-day stuff is so much better when you give yourself that time. But it's leaning into that initial, but what if, and going, yeah, but it can be like this instead.
Mm. Yeah,
absolutely. And if your entire self-worth is built on your productivity, the risk of doing something that's going to reduce that is like, nope, not going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And also get really honest with yourself. Is it that you want to grind harder and be the best possible version of yourself? Or are you like using being busy and productivity as kind of a coping mechanism to avoid distracting them from other things happening? I think sometimes that can get mixed up where people were like, oh, I just want to work really hard, but actually they're running for the hills. Like they're trying really hard to
We don't know about that, Becca. No.
Attacked.
Yeah, but you're so right. And so many of our clients go through that of overcoming their relationship with food. And then they're like, oh, I've noticed this draw. I've become very busy. Interesting. Not so much anymore. I don't think that happens, but we've definitely had conversations around this. It's like, oh, well, you've maybe replaced one habit to try and self-regulate food with another habit to try and self-regulate. None of them are helpful self-regulation tools, or they are in the moment, but, you know, not helpful long-term. It's just that one is societally praised.
Yeah.
To be fair, so is disordered eating. If it leads to, you know, if it's diet in line with diet culture narrative, that's also societally praised. So it's a hard one to get out of. Okay. Is it normal to have one's current concept of self break away while working on the relationship with food, body, exercise? That's not the only thing I'm working on, although deeply rooted and intertwined with everything else. So this person is working with me and also working with a therapist as well.
Yeah, it is really common, definitely, because your sense of self, like your identity, has been intertwined with like your habits and behaviors all along. That's a really common thing to happen, where you sort of merge your behaviors and yourself together, and now you're in a place where you have support and you're going to be gaining the awareness of like your true authentic self is separate to your behaviors and your habits, or maybe your disordered tendencies or whatever it is. So that can take time to then kind of, it's almost like rediscovering, or maybe finding out who you are for the first time ever. Like maybe you've never even thought about it before. So yeah, it is, it's really common, and it can be scary, but it can also be reframed as exciting, because like that is exciting. It's a new chapter in a sense of figuring out like who you are beyond all this, with hopefully more headspace and energy to give to those other areas.
I think too, this is where that sense of grief and loss can come in, of who you thought you were. You're not that person. You're still obviously the same person. You're still the soul underneath it. And that's what you're uncovering. And a lot of this work is about stripping back all of this stuff and kind of getting to what's actually underneath. But you can feel a sense of loss for that person. And I think as well, when you're slightly younger, you are very much, you can become the person that you think that you should be, or you're supposed to be, or, you know, what you've kind of been programmed to be through societal norms, etc., through finding your worth and being super productive and achievements and all of these things. So when you start to develop a sense of self outside of these things, then of course that entire sense of self that you had before is like, oh, that was just a mask, or that was just like a bodysuit I was wearing. And actually that's, you're taking that off and you're uncovering what's underneath. And it's a really incredible process. There's a book that we've spoken about before called Broken Open. And that's more about, you know, when you go through a really hard time in your life, maybe it's grief, it could be different things. And we love that. I mean, I love that book. And it explains this to some degree, this type of situation where you're basically like a phoenix, and you disappear and you turn to ashes, and then you rise again as this golden phoenix. And obviously when I got the book, I was like, oh, I need to get a phoenix tattoo. And didn't, got a necklace instead, don't worry. But it does describe this type of thing really well, of, you know, these really hard times, whatever these hard times are, once you move through them, it's transformative, and so it's incredible. And this person does a lot of work. Sometimes when you're working on your relationship with food, and I imagine some people listening to the podcast might be in this situation, that maybe are not working with us yet, you can kind of tick the boxes, you know, doing the mindfulness and doing the meditation, but I kind of just do it before I go to bed, and I'm doing my yoga class once a week, but it's hot yoga and I'm like, you know, sweating my balls off and it's really intense. And you're ticking the boxes of what you think you should be doing, but you don't always necessarily get to the deeper level of that. And it might be because you don't have the support, it might be because it's so scary that you actually are not really ready to do that. There are lots of reasons why it's not through a fault of your own by any means, but this person, this example and this person has really gone to like the depths of, I'm going to fully embrace this, I'm going to really lean into all of this really uncomfortable thing. And that's why she's going through this kind of big transformation at this point. And not everyone will go through this, but it's not, certainly not uncommon.
What would you say was the hardest thing for you whilst recovering your relationship with food? And what would you say was the number one thing that helped it? If you could go back and start again with your relationship with food journey, what would you tell yourself?
Ooh. What was the first part? What was the thing that made it worse or made it
hard?
What
was the hardest and what was the number one thing that helped?
For me, the hardest part was being in a really inconsistent, toxic relationship, which we don't really talk about enough. I lived with this person. He was my major, he was my co-regulator, and he was had a lot of his own struggles. And as a result of that, when I was coming out of bodybuilding and trying to improve my relationship with food, my home life was very, you know, it was unsafe. It was inconsistent, and so it didn't matter that I was removing tracking and eating mindfully and starting to meditate. I would meditate when I was on a walk because I wouldn't want to do it at home because I didn't know how to explain what I was doing. I felt silly, and there were, you know, arguments and things like that. So, and I was so unaware of the impact of that environment on my own nervous system and therefore my own recovery, that it didn't even really cross my mind that that was one of the things, the reasons why I was struggling to move through things. And that was when I'd kind of improved my relationship with food to quite a decent degree, but I was still getting out the remaining dregs of, you know, the last spell of that. So for me, that was what made it the hardest, and was my environment. And what the most transformative thing for me was meditation. I stand by that being one of the most important things I've ever done in my life. And it worries me that I could one day just don't meditate anymore. It's one of my biggest fears of like, oh, if I can't do it anymore, I think that would be really hard to deal with. But I think it taught me mindfulness. It taught me compassion. It taught me to be aware of my thoughts. It directed me towards some of my favorite, like, kind of thought leaders that I still look at now and read their work now. So I think that was, for me, that was probably the key thing. What are yours? Any of yours?
For me, the hardest, I think, because I've been on sort of both sides of the coin, where overeating, emotional eating was like my go-to, especially when I was younger, like childhood, teenage years. And then obviously it kind of went the other way, where restricting, controlling my food was my coping mechanism. Like, my friends used to always say, oh, when Becca's off with her boyfriend, a past, like my first ever boyfriend, she's gonna get skinny. Like, that was my way of just focusing everything in on, I'm just gonna restrict, and yeah, just really neglect and basically starve myself as a way to cope with my feelings and to control something, obviously, when everything else felt out of control. So then obviously you need a new coping mechanism and you need a way to deal with things. For me, that new way of doing things was actually to think about how I was feeling and to start talking to people and opening up, because I used to keep everything very much inside. So that was the most challenging part, learning to be open and to actually let yourself feel things, to let myself feel things. The game changer then, I would say, or the thing that helped, was developing a relationship with my body, because I didn't have one then. Like, my body was just something that was supposed to look a certain way that I compared to everyone else and that I used to take out emotion on. So actually finding an appreciation for it, that kind of links in with self-compassion then as well, which was so alien to me, I can't even explain. And I often, like you with meditation, I have those moments of like, if I didn't know how to do self-compassion, or if I wasn't open to it, I genuinely don't know what my life would look like today. And it still surprises me so much when some people say like, oh, I don't think about showing myself kindness, or I don't turn kindness inward. Like, it still surprises me that people don't actually practice it, because I'm like, how do you get by? But of course they don't. Like, I didn't once. But yeah.
I have a question for you. Do you find talking about your feelings now very easy? And do you find self-compassion now very easy, and or both?
No, I don't find talking about my feelings easy. I find self-compassion much easier now. Like, it comes habitually. Talking about my feelings, I mean, I've obviously gone through like quite a bit of therapy, so I've been forced into doing that. Like, and as well, just with this type of work, all that, you need to be open to your feelings. But I still can't say I find it easy. Like, I don't find it comfortable, I would say, but more comfortable, a lot more comfortable. So maybe one day I will. Maybe one day, yeah, I'll be like, I love it.
I always wonder if that will happen, because I think even Brené Brown's not like, oh, this is easy. And if she's not like, this is easy, then I think, oh, it's fine that I don't find it easy, because Brené Brown doesn't find it easy. And, you know, it's obviously fine. she's the milestone.
I think for me, though, it's not so much the being vulnerable and like sharing what's going on for me. Like, there's, in terms of like it being shameful or anything, it's more the those like old messages of, am I being too much? Is this sounding dramatic? It's the noise that comes with it, rather than the actual sharing of like, yeah, this is happening in my life, or the thought of making someone else feeling uncomfortable.
Oh, it's so much same. It's like the people pleaser or the too much, 100%. I'm like, what? Am I gaslighting myself right now? I think I am. What a treat. What about you, Anna?
I think the hardest, I mean, there's so many, right? The hardest thing. I think, obviously, coming from background of competing, the hardest thing was letting go of the control, or trying to control my body. But on the flip side, the best thing I did, aside from reaching out to you, was just letting go of the control around food and just kind of going, yeah, do you know what? I don't want it anymore. It's not on me. Someone else like is here to support me and keep me, or make sure that I'm doing what I need to be doing. So I don't need to give this energy right now. And I mean, don't get me wrong, it was hard, but it's one of the best things that I did, because I just, when I say it, just stopped caring. But it just didn't take up the mental space. And then I could allow everything else back in, and found that naturally then food preoccupation, body preoccupation just massively reduced.
Yeah. You know what? That's actually so interesting. And it's something that I've never thought about in all of these years of doing this work, that one of the best parts, or one of the most transformative parts of working with ETPHD as a whole, if you struggle with control around food, is the trust in us that we're controlling it in some way. Like, we're not obviously meticulously controlling it, but we're taking the reins that gives you permission to let go of the control of your food. And I don't know why I've never thought of it. That's so obvious. But just the way that you framed that there.
Genuinely, I think that is how I, even if it wasn't like the thought, it was someone else is doing this for me, so I don't need to. It's going to be okay. Yeah. And genuinely, it was never like, I don't think I connected those dots in, you're controlling my food, but I knew that I just didn't have to think about it. It was okay.
Mm. Just FYI, we don't actually physically control anyone's food. In case that's what you think's happening here. Interesting.
But it is, I often say, like, just trust me, trust the process, like, let go of the pressure of getting it right, that you've been trying so hard to get it so right. Like, let that go now, if you can at all possible, even a tiny, tiny bit at each time. So it's kind of surrendering almost. Okay, we're going to just let this play out, and we're going to trust the coach who's supporting me. And that's how you define support, isn't it, as well? Like, someone guiding you along and actually wanting what you want for yourself, and doing what it takes to get that outcome for you.
Mm.
Yeah. Like, it's hard to trust at the start, especially.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's why, you know, we work really hard to try and encourage you to trust us with the content that we put out and the podcast and stuff, because we know how hard that is. And I think even, you know, with Tom, who I'm who's doing my training at the moment, as much as I'm a nightmare for him, because I'm like, I don't want to do this and I don't want to do that, a lot of that is still some sort of inherent control thing that I've got in that, even though I wasn't programming my training ideally, I was just going through the motions, I still had, it was still run by me. And so that, you know, I know Tom relatively well, so I trust that he knows what he's doing. But even then, like, the only reason that when I have a little bit of a wobble, that I feel okay about it is because I'm like, yeah, but you know, you've got control of it, so I really don't need to worry. And yeah, never thought about it like that. Interesting. Becca, question.
Okay. Will I ever be in a position where I can lose weight safely with no binging repercussions? At the minute, I feel like I'm in a body I don't want and cannot accept, and there's nothing I can do about it.
The answer is probably yes. But I don't know who asked this question, and I don't know your situation, your background, et cetera, et cetera. Most people that come to us who have a fat loss goal and who are binge eating successfully lose fat and successfully stop binge eating and then successfully lose fat. If they still want to do that when they've successfully stopped binge eating, and that's a disclaimer, because some people will improve their relationship with food initially with a fat loss goal and then get to the point where actually they're healthy, they're happy, they're content, and they don't want to lose fat anymore. And so they don't lose fat because they don't want to. But for those who still do. There are many ETPHD podcasts around dieting after healing your relationship with food. So feel free to listen to all of those ones. But honestly, you have to, I would encourage you to drop the expectation that you have that it will take X amount of time. Because it might take less time than you think. It might take more time than you think. You might have anticipated after 4 weeks never binging again, for example. And maybe that's true for some people, but maybe for other people it's not true. And, you know, we know what the process of coaching with us looks like in terms of if you're binge eating and have a fat loss goal. We know that the first phase will look like improving your relationship with food. We know that that will incorporate mindfulness, compassion, you know, certain pillars. And then we know that you'll move on to a fat loss goal if that's still what's important to you. But we will never say that will take 8 weeks, that will take 8 weeks, that will take 8 weeks, because it's not possible to do that. But if you have an expectation, you're getting frustrated at you not meeting the expectations that you have. And I wonder if it's possible for you to actually just focus on the process that you're in right now and trying to enjoy and be proud of doing this work that not everyone is willing to do, that you are restoring this relationship with food, with your body, developing self-worth, developing self-esteem, developing trust in yourself. I wonder if you can focus on all of those incredible wins for now and trust, again, like we were saying before, trust that the coach that you're working with knows that you have a fat loss goal. We don't forget that. You know, when just because we don't talk about fat loss to you every single week doesn't mean that we've forgotten that that's the reason that you came to us in the first place. We know that. It's just that it's not helpful in your recovery from binge eating to talk about fat loss all the time. I don't know if anyone, actually I do know, I can guarantee that people listen to this podcast, maybe someone who's been a client in the past, maybe, I don't know, has been through this process of improving your relationship with food, maybe overeating a little bit on holiday, coming back from holiday as an example, and then saying, oh, it's fine, I'll go into a little bit of a diet on Monday, and over that weekend overeating. I can almost guarantee it. For a lot of people who improve their relationship with food and they're maybe not quite at the end of that journey yet, they want to go into a diet phase immediately, they'll find they start overeating again. This planned anticipatory restriction, there's some cool research around this. I think Holly did post on it actually, but this anticipatory restriction can lead to overeating and binge eating in advance of restriction, which is why we're not saying every single week, fat loss, fat loss, fat loss. But we will always know that that is one of your goals.
Just thinking about the second part of that question, I would look at the pressure that you're putting on yourself and the expectations that you're putting on yourself in terms of what your relationship with your body should, needs to look like, and what a healthy relationship with your body actually is, or what a healthy body image actually is, because we will never tell you that you're going to get to a place where you love every single part of your body, because that is very unrealistic. But we can get you to a place certainly where there's acceptance and peace and appreciation for your body. So I think, like I said, just take a check in with the expectations of what you think it should be like, And as Amelia was saying, just kind of focus on what you're doing and the process and enjoying the process along the way rather than honing in on the end goal.
Yeah. The only other thing I would add is to remind yourself that your habits at the moment, and if you are struggling with binge eating, that is also going to impact how you feel in your body. So often if our eating habits feel out of control, we can also feel out of control with our physical body, or we can anticipate it as something, maybe sometimes something that it's not, but also it can skew our perception or, you know, impact how we feel basically in ourselves. So as your relationship with food improves, and as you feel more like you have the ability to be more mindful and feel control in a positive way around your food, that's going to also help with your body image. 9 times out of 10 it does. So, you know, you might get to a place where you have more acceptance, even if your body doesn't change a whole pile. Maybe that doesn't resonate with you right now, but maybe it will at some point. So as Amelia and you were saying, Anna, it's like, come back to what you're doing today, the process today, and focus on all the other stuff like self-esteem and how you're feeling as a whole.
But, agreed. Okay. Oh, sorry. I said to myself, so this person is a coach, and she said, I said to myself this week, if I met my business goals, I would, quote unquote, treat myself to a Domino's, and this would be completely nourishing. However, when I met my business goals, I didn't follow through. I assumed a red flag in my language of, quote unquote, treat. Do you think there's space to use the words that once indicated dichotomous thinking in a space of health and balance? It's a great question, isn't it?
I think so. And the reason I think that, like, I was thinking I treat myself to a Domino's because I bloody love pizza, but the treat is I'm not cooking tonight. that's the treat for me. It's not the food itself. A treat might also be going to my mum's for dinner and letting her cook for me. That's the treat. And I think maybe reflecting on kind of why you didn't follow through with that, or would you have still have allowed yourself a Domino's at the end of the week if you hadn't have met your business goals, and just checking in there rather than assuming an instant red flag.
I agree, having a Domino's can be a treat experience. It's not just like, okay, I have to have some, I'm going to have some treat food because I've earned this treat food. But there's also this horrible diet culture narrative of, like, remember that meme that used to go around? It was like, you're not a dog, you don't need to reward yourself with food. I'm like, I am a dog, okay, give me my pizza, I would like to reward myself with food. Like, it was really odd. And that was at a time when diet culture, like, stripped the idea that you can enjoy food out of preference and connection and social times. And so I think, like, it's okay to treat yourself with a takeaway that, like you said, Alan, that you don't have to cook, that you really enjoy, that's maybe a bit more money than you normally spend on food, and it's a reward, and that's, I think, that's totally okay. And to demonize that is quite diet culture-esque. And so, yeah, I mean, I agree. I think there is space to use this kind of, quote unquote, dichotomous language around food, or thinking around food in that way. But you are right in the sense of you are worthy. And this is probably less about your relationship with food and more about your self-worth and your relationship with yourself and your business. You are worthy of an enjoyable experience, even if you haven't been as productive as you'd like. And again, this kind of ties into Monday's podcast, but why do you have to achieve a certain amount of things in order to treat yourself in a way that you, in a compassionate and kind way? Mm-hmm. Anna?
Is it back to me? It's back to me already. What are ways to decrease novelty around foods besides the increased exposure? How do I move to become more neutral around triggering foods? So, for example, this client has been has been including foods often, but still finding that certain ones haven't lost their novelty yet and are harder to be mindful around.
I think your last bit of the sentence, like, haven't lost their novelty yet, that's exactly what it is. It's like sometimes it just takes time, and you're not just going to have one bar of chocolate and then be like, oh, you know, especially if you've restricted it and you found it really hard to be mindful with it. It's not just one bar. It's like consistently having it in your diet in a mindful way over time is what I would say. So give yourself a chance and to like practice doing it when you're regulated and not just when you're dysregulated. Making sure that like you are actively doing this, and I'm sure you are if you're working with Anna, like having it when you are feeling, you know, on it, quote unquote on it, and you're not just leaving it to the days where you're, you know, the way sometimes when you're trying to improve your relationship with food, it can almost feel like a justification, like, well, I'm trying to overcome all this, so I'm going to have those foods now, and it can feel very much like a justification. So making sure that you're doing it across the board as best you can. I'm trying to think what else. Exposure is the main one when it comes to removing that novelty.
I agree. The other thing I would say is looking at what you mean by novelty, because I still, not so much since I got back from Austin, I think I said this to you, Anna, but like I still get excited when I get Domino's pizza. I still eat past food.
You were so worried that you wouldn't.
No, well, I was like, it doesn't taste the same. I was very upset, but I still get excited by it. I still eat a bit past fullness when I get it. And it's still something that I do look forward to it most Friday nights when I finished my work and I'm like, okay, gonna get Domino's. That's not novelty. That's genuine joy and enjoyment from the experience that comes with Domino's and reality TV for me. Like that, I love that experience. And so sometimes we can confuse that anticipation and excitement and joy with novelty because we haven't had that anticipation and joy from food experiences for so long. So we don't 100% know how to recognize that in ourselves. And so I don't know if this is the case for you, but just check in with the fact of, is it novelty and you're mindlessly overeating a lot of that because of the novelty, or is it that actually you really enjoy it and you're eating a little bit more because it's actually just really good and you're enjoying the experience?
Yeah. And you're looking forward to it. Like, I definitely look forward to my dinner meal every day. Like every day I'm like, oh, it's dinner time. Like, I'm looking forward to sitting down and actually enjoying this. So, and yeah, like you said, if you haven't had that for forever, like if you're in that restrictive mindset, trying to eat as little as possible, you don't really get that same feeling with meals. Well, actually that's a lie. You probably do because you're preoccupied by food, but it's a different feeling. It's less urgent and panicky, and it doesn't come with as much noise in your head. So yeah, maybe it's just a case of getting used to actually being able to look forward and then enjoy it as well. And you're not anticipating all the guilt and negative feelings that come with it anymore, so that could have been a bit of a deterrent as well for you. I'm not sure.
Just a couple of bits to add. I think check in, are you telling yourself that you can only have certain amounts and like still putting conditions around those foods? Are you opting for, like, you know, like you were saying, like the tick box in I've had whatever that food is, but is it actually like the good stuff? Like if we take chocolate, for example, are you sticking with like the 80% dark chocolate where actually a row of Galaxy is probably going to taste, not probably, it 100% is going to taste a lot better. And I think sometimes as well, almost like what you were saying with the anticipatory stuff, like, is it worth, like, are you saving it to have at the end of the day where actually it is maybe more of a struggle to be as mindful because you've kind of built it up that anticipation, whereas actually having it, I don't know, in your morning snack, so you've had the taste and the satisfaction, and you still have the option later on to adding it to, I don't know, your bowl of oats in the evening. that might be a helpful way just to kind of, again, increase exposure, but it's not building up throughout the day and making it more difficult.
You know what you've just reminded me of? In my cupboard, I've got cashew nut spread, which is a Lidl version, but I thought it was like cashew nut spread, but it's actually like white chocolate spread. It's like, when I looked at the ingredients, I was like, oh, you're not cashew nut spread. However, phenomenal. And I'm going to have that on my oats. Thanks for reminding me about that. I forgot that was in there. It's been in there for quite a long time, actually, so I'm questioning if it's okay, but I'll just skip the mold off.
Never tried cashew nut butter. Is it anything? Because I love.
Dream. Like, I mean, it's so creamy, and it's one of those things, a bit like rice cakes. For me, it was, I'd have a Quest bar with cashew nut butter when I got off stage, and it sat with me, and it's still the best thing even now. I'm like, yes, this is dreamy.
What, you just dip in?
Mm.
Interesting. I've never had a protein bar with nut butter before.
No, me either.
Oh, you've missed out. Like, it's still to this day, I'll microwave a grenade bar, because apparently nowhere sells Quest bars. Mm. And then drizzle some nut butter on top.
Microwaved one since, for a long time.
Yeah, that's a throwback and a half. Interesting. Okay, you might try that. Is it me?
Becca.
Me.
Sorry, go Becca.
Do you think you need to share your struggles with food relationship with friends and family to be able to recover? Like, I think it's common with a lot of people that struggle with food. It's private/secretive, that I feel very embarrassed about it and haven't shared with anyone really before starting coaching. I'm a very independent person and I don't feel like I want to share it, but do wonder if that hinders recovery a bit.
There's no need to do anything. However, the antidote to shame is
empathy. Waiting for Brené.
Is empathy from someone that you trust. And if you feel a lot of shame around something, if you can be vulnerable with someone that you trust and they can show you empathy, that is extremely helpful in removing some shame. And removing some shame will help your recovery. So logically, it's helpful. But I would like to say that, think, you might struggle with telling your family, or you might struggle with telling certain friends because the relationship you have with them, that's maybe not your dynamic. And I, you know, from my personal experience, it's changed as, you know, maybe in my 30s, but, you know, within my family, I always felt like I had a bit of a certain role, which I spoke about before. And so I would find it easier to write an email about, you know, struggling in that relationship with food back in the day than I would speaking to my mum about it. And to be quite honest, I'd say that's probably still true to some degree. I totally understand. And it's not a reflection of your relationship or your strength of your relationship with people. It's just you have different dynamics with different people, and that's totally okay. So I don't think it's like a case of you should tell people that you love the most, because it's also not about how much you love someone. It might be easier for you to talk to a therapist or your coach or a friend that actually, you know, maybe is a newer friend. You might find that easier and you trust them to speak to them than someone that you love deeply and have known for your entire life. So I think it's about maybe finding that person that you do feel like, I could maybe have this conversation with them, but not pressuring yourself to do it. But maybe over time you find that you are able to talk about it a little bit more, and most of the time that it's helpful and supportive in our experience, I think, at least in my experience with people.
Yeah, and I think reminding yourself that having that vulnerable conversation with someone you trust doesn't necessarily mean like it's pour your heart out, tell them everything. It might be one of those things like you just start up a little conversation and, oh, we've both got struggles here, and it feels safe for you then to kind of build on it rather than go in kind of all guns blazing, like, I'm ready to share everything with you here right now.
Yeah, that's a good point. Everyone's got their stuff. Everyone has got stuff. It's just that you're aware of yours and some people are not. And some people they are aware of, but you're just not aware of their stuff. We've all got it. Okay. It would be helpful to know and understand how the work done with you guys stays in our mind and we don't lose what we're learning. That's a fear for me that I will yo-yo again.
You probably, I don't know if yo-yo the best word to use, but usually there's a back and forth in some way that you might find yourself going back to old ways. And then like when you're still coaching, we can use that as sort of a learning and okay, how will we navigate this when it pops up again? So it's almost part of the process that you will go back and forth. And then even sometimes if you get to a place where you're not going back as frequently, something might pop up in your life where you do and you revert to old unhelpful ways. But again, it's like, it's not going backwards or losing sort of what you've been working on. It's part of it. And even no matter how far along you are in your journey, that can happen, but it's just, we want it to be less frequent or less intense when it happens, or yeah, it doesn't last as long. So realistic expectations, I think, first and foremost, but then also just becoming consistent with things is how you ingrain it, isn't it? And seeing the benefits from that consistency, it almost does become habitual then at some point. And it can feel like, oh no, that's never going to become a habit for me because it's such an effort at this point in time. But like, it does, like, that's what we always say, like, keep at it and keep going, even when it feels hard and uncomfortable. That's how you get to the place where it feels some way enjoyable or easier than it has been before.
Yeah. Like you said, you're building new habit loops, and that kind of ties into the concept of neuroplasticity. Like it will become these things will become your go-to tools without you necessarily thinking about it. It's that unconscious competence at that top of the hierarchy that we speak about all the time, the hierarchy of competence. But it then becomes your new ingrained habit. It's so it doesn't require you to have that conscious choice. And like you said, sometimes there will be slips in that and you can recognize, oh, that, like, I've moved back to maybe my old coping behaviors. I need to retrain myself and come back into this new neural pathway that I built for all of those months that I worked with Becca. I think this is your client. All of those months I worked with Becca, built those new loops. They're there. They'll require less and less conscious thought as time goes on, but not, you know, not no conscious thought whatsoever. Okay, fabulous. I think we'll stop there. Thank you all for the great questions. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And as always, if you did, please do feel free to like, share, subscribe, and review. And if you would like to chat to me, then you can find details of my Instagram in the show notes.